Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of June. This hour of the program, the current exhibition, groundbreaking exhibits at the Milwaukee Art Museum. They're going on through the summer months, and we here at Public Radio in Milwaukee had a chance to go through the wonderful exhibits during a preview just a couple weeks ago. It's American Originals through two groundbreaking exhibits, and we will be talking with the director of exhibits, Lori Winter, who joins us from time to time at the Milwaukee Art Museum and has put together some fabulous exhibits. Also joining us will be the curator of the American Decorative Art 1900 Foundation in New York, author and curator of the book and exhibition The Artistic Furniture of Charles Rolfs, and Elizabeth Kennedy will be joining us, curator of collection at the Terra Foundation of American Art in Chicago. Lori, always a pleasure to have you on the air. Hello.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you here. And also joining us from Chicago, Elizabeth Kennedy from the Terra Foundation of American Art in Chicago to talk about The Eight. Elizabeth, thank you for being with us.
Oh, I'm delighted. Thank you.
Yeah, great to have you here. We enjoyed your tour, as we did enjoy the tour of Joseph Cunningham, curator of the American Decorative Art 1900 Foundation in New York. And Joseph, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having us to talk.
Yeah. Let's start with you, Lori. We were talking about putting these exhibits together. Tell me what the thinking was behind this and just an overview of what the exhibits are.
Yeah, sure. Both exhibitions emerged as independent concepts, and at a very early stage we realized that they represented a kind of common thinking, an artistic thinking that was prevalent in American art around the turn of the century. So it became an obvious connection for us, became an obvious connection for us to combine them in our large Baker Rowland exhibition space. They complement each other perfectly. The Charles Rolfs exhibition deals with American decorative arts, furniture design at the turn of the century, and The Eight and American Modernisms deals with the eight independent artists working in the United States as a kind of collaborative effort, but with very unique and distinct voices. And my colleagues, Betsy Kennedy and Joe Cunningham, can talk a little bit more about the kind of independent nature of these artists and what that meant for the turn of the century.
Okay. And you want to start with you, Joseph? This guy was quite an adventurer in many ways. I understand he was a Shakespearean actor, and the exhibit is his very unusual, very interesting designs. Tell me about that exhibit.
Absolutely. Charles Rolfs ranked among really the most innovative furniture makers and designers around 1900, but he didn't come to making furniture through conventional means. He was, as you mentioned, a Shakespearean actor in the late 19th century, and he also was a pretty successful industrial designer. He designed and built cast iron stoves around that time as well. But in the end, he really did lead toward this what he called his life's work, the artistic design of furniture, which he commenced with around 1897. And one of the remarkable things about him is that he only made furniture for about a decade. So all of the incredible objects that are on view at the Milwaukee Art Museum were made in just a 10-year period between about 1897 and 1907. He was recognized around the world during his own time. He was praised by the international press, and he was exhibited throughout the world, was appreciated quite a lot also in Europe. But one of the interesting things about his work is that it comes out of such a wide range of eclectic influences that were circulating around the turn of the century that he's been very difficult to categorize, which is probably one of the reasons why it took so long for there to be organized a major exhibition of his work.
What he said about himself, my designs are my own, I evolve them, they are like those of no other period nor people. Is that true? Is he an American original in many ways?
Well, I think one of the most exciting things about his work is the way in which he had a particular vision of beauty that was unlike anyone else of his time or perhaps any other time. And I think there is something very sincere to his words there. He did use a range of influences from literally all around the world, from Moorish to Islamic, from Scandinavian to Germanic traditions of design. And one of the most interesting things about his work is that he can bring them together in very, very exciting new ways. So even if you're able to recognize one design one design element off a piece of his work from some kind of international influence, the way he filters it through his own sort of sense of personal expression is really quite distinctive.
Mm-hmm. And this particular exhibit is unusual, isn't it, Laurie? And it's the first time all of this has been brought together, all of his work has been brought together under one roof, that it's been kind of scattered, right?
It's the first exhibition on Charles Roth's as an independent thinker, independent artist, and really identifying his role at the turn of the century. You know, there have been a number of exhibitions on Mission Furniture and Art Nouveau and Stickley and so forth, and sort of all of these other voices at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the early 20th century. And interestingly, Roth's has not fit into any of those categories, and that's with good reason, because he is an independent voice. So this is the first exhibition, and we are with ADA 1900, the organizing institutional ESOL with Chipstone Foundation. And I'm very excited to say that after it leaves here at the end of the summer, it's going to be going to some major venues. And so that's exciting as well. It's going to go to the Fort Worth Museum of Art, the Dallas Museum of Art, the Carnegie Museum, the Huntington in California. And then I think the greatest thing of all is that it will close at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Oh, my.
So it starts at Milwaukee and concludes at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And that's a tribute to the organizers and to Joe Cunningham for all of his great scholarship on this exhibition.
Yes. And why the first exhibition? Was he undiscovered? Was he unappreciated for all these years? Or
well,
what was it?
You know, I'm hoping we have a minute or so to ask Joe about his discovery of the Roth's family and heirs in Colorado, because I think that's a great story. So, Joe, if you'd like to talk about that, that'd be wonderful.
Sure. Well, since the early 1970s, when Robert Judson Clark first came upon Charles Roth and actually interviewed his son Roland at that time, he's been a character, just as Laurie described, who's kind of moved in and out of the arts and crafts attention, in and out of the Art Nouveau kinds of exhibitions, but he's never really been explored on his own terms. And so when we started research about 4 years ago for this show, the most important thing for Sarah Fan, the Chipstone curator, and me to really accomplish right away was to find Charles Roth's heirs. And we were actually able to do that by tracking them down through Social Security records. And we realized it's one of the wonderful things about public records. You can actually track people down. If you're, sort of really hardworking, you can find people. And so we actually tracked them down living in far western Colorado, and we were able to locate the great-granddaughter of Charles Roth. And what was remarkable was that she had a little bit of the family furniture still in her possession, which was exciting, but what was much more exciting was the discovery that she had all of the family papers, all of the records, the diaries, the correspondence, the period images of objects. And she was incredibly kind in sharing all of this information with us. Her name is Lisa Ortman, and she does live still in far western Colorado. And she recently, subsequent to our research, she did in fact donate all of these wonderful family papers on Charles Roth to the Winterthur Library in Delaware. So not only were we able to use all of this incredible, primary research material in evolving the exhibition and the book project, but subsequently she's made all of this available to the public, where it will be, available now forever and ever. And so that was a really wonderful sort of side story of our research.
She was just waiting for your call, Joseph. Right?
Well, I hope so. She was, she was a little bit, as you can imagine, she was a little bit of undone by Sarah and I, sort of poring over her family papers. And she had this whole process of realization that, her great-grandfather was a really important furniture maker and that these family papers were really, incredibly useful to researchers. And we're just so grateful to her, not only for her, her making them available to us, but now, of course, they're available to the public forever.
Yeah. The other part, of course, of the exhibition is the eight. And, I wasn't aware of these artists, and it's a wonderful exhibition. You could make a whole exhibition out of each one of the eight artists. Can you give us an overview before we talk to Elizabeth about the importance of these artists?
Yeah, it's very important because Betsy Kennedy has a kind of revisionist approach to the material. And as you know, at the Milwaukee Art Museum, we love these kinds of topics with exhibitions where we can come afresh to an idea where people thought they knew something. And we can rethink that and present these ideas in a new way. So this has had great appeal for us. And as you know, the Milwaukee Art Museum has a fantastic collection of the eight artists, and Betsy Kennedy will identify them for you. But as it turns out, the Terra Foundation in Chicago also has a great collection of eight, and the New Britain Museum. So to the credit goes for this exhibition idea to the Terra Foundation and Betsy Kennedy. She thought, why not bring all of these exceptional works together from three institutions in the United States and put them together and let them tell the story of a new way of thinking about the eight. And it really is a kind of dramatic new way of thinking about the eight. So I'll just let her share that with you.
So, yeah, Elizabeth.
Yes.
You're on.
Well, first of all, I like to think that this project is a little bit like the eight artists coming together in 1907 to form their own opportunity to exhibit together. And what's sort of a remarkable story is it's a two-week exhibition that takes place in February of 2009, self-organized by the eight artists, that becomes legendary. And one of the reasons it does is because the exhibition tours the following year in 1909, and it comes to the Midwest. It comes to Chicago. It doesn't come to Milwaukee, but Cincinnati, Pittsburgh. But the importance of these eight artists is that was not limited to New York. They were very important throughout the country, and especially Midwestern communities that had art schools. And an incredible legacy of this is their independence, their individualism. And what I'm standing on the shoulders of others in, as a matter of fact, at MAM in the early 1990s, Elizabeth Milroy put together an exhibition on the eight, and she was very distinct in saying these are about these eight artists and not the ashcan artists, which is how we normally have been led to think about these eight individuals. And it's been a very misleading categorization, as Joe
mentioned. Can you say that again? What was that description? A what?
The Ashcan School.
The Ashcan School. You need to just briefly tell me what that is.
Well, exactly. In 1908, when these eight rebellious artists came together, their art was very different from the standard National Academy of Design artists that was more genteel, and it was certainly looking more to Europe. Well, four of these eight artists had been journalists, and they had been artists for newspapers, and they had followed timely stories and reported on the day-to-day, and often subjects that were of city scenes of New York or Philadelphia. And in 1934, the director of the Museum of Modern Art was, again, needing to put these artists in some kind of category, and he said, well, the ashcan artists, because they were always doing street scenes of New York. But in reality, and then later, let me step back and say that in Americanists who studied this period, became sort of dependent on this idea of just the ashcan and not looking at the later careers of these artists. And as scholars in the 50s and 60s wrote them off as not being important because they still were interested in the figure and not just doing abstract or non-representational art. So the premise of the show is that these eight artists continued to be important after 1908 and even after 1913 when the famous Armory Show took place in New York City that introduced the American public to European modernism. And it's also a show that came to Chicago. So I want to emphasize that the Midwest was not left out in ideas about modernism in American art.
And, Lori, my sense in seeing all of them is that the artists are really very different from each other, aren't they?
I think that, yeah. And that's really part of the point that Betsy and the exhibition makes, is that they are these eight unique voices who realized that they only came together because they were unique and independent. You know, it's an interesting, you know, as I've thought about this exhibition, it's interesting to think about some, you know, sort of earlier groups of artists. And I guess perhaps the best well-known group of artists that sort of worked together is the Impressionists. So Monet, Renoir, and so forth, working together, but they have a common interest in light and ephemeral effects and sort of the transience of day, and they have that kind of common ground and common voice. Interestingly, the eight are also a group of artists who come together, not unlike the Impressionists in their relationships, but they really have a different understanding of what they're trying to accomplish. And they go about that in very different ways. So we tend to group them, I think, somewhat mistakenly, thanks to the sort of confusion in the 1930s. And our need as sort of art historians and to make sense of these broad cultural movements, we tend to put everything under simple labels and generic labels. And truth be told, that can be misleading. And I think Betsy and the Terra Foundation and the partnering institutions have done a great job going back to this material and assessing it on its own unique merits. Mm-hmm. And so what I like about both of these exhibitions is that they really offer us a unique perspective of the cultural and cultural identity of the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. That artists began to think of themselves as, and I've said this now a couple times, but as unique and independent voices. And that is part of the American identity. And in some ways, I think this anticipates much of the artistic identity that we've now come to take for granted in the 20th century and now in the 21st century about unique voices in the artistic world.
Mm-hmm. Is there something unusual? Let me ask all of you this, starting with you, Elizabeth. You talked about several of the artists. I don't know exactly how many were journalists. And we have Rolfs, who's a Shakespearean actor then, who also does this furniture. Is this kind of unusual for these people to have these other professions that are all demanding? Being a journalist is a big thing. Being a Shakespearean actor, I would think, is a big thing as well. And then have these very, very fulfilling and deeply absorbing other interests in life.
I would say for the professional artists of the eight that these early jobs working for the newspapers were part of their career path. Just as others went on to be teachers at art schools or art advisors, these early days of their careers, this is the way they made their living. But they were all interested in becoming fine artists. They all wanted to become painters. Mm-hmm. And John Sloan is interesting, as he's a very accomplished printmaker before he actually earns his way as a painter. So in many respects, I don't know if it's quite the same as the individuality that Rolfs exhibits. Joseph can talk to that. But I think in this particular case, these artists were, to become an artist is a long process. You go to school, you have these other jobs. And often when they talk about these young men of 1908, they were already in their mid-40s. They were not exactly young in age, if you will. But they were also interested in being of this era and of the moment. So that's where the modernisms comes in with an S, because each of these artists thought that they were being modern in one way or the other, as the quote goes. And I think that's sort of an important concept that from the eight to Rolfs, they each had their own sense of individuality and contribution that they wanted to make as artists.
Mm-hmm. And Joseph, tell us more about Rolfs in that regard.
Well, I think that the points that Laurie has made are very relevant. And I think that the way I might encapsulate a little bit about Rolfs with respect to this topic is a sense of openness. I think he thought of industrial design, of Shakespearean acting, of furniture design as all being open to his own need for personal expression. And it's that kind of thing that kind of brews up in an artist and needs to find a way out. And what's interesting about Rolfs is it found a number of different ways out, which is kind of an exciting and really a modern way of thinking. We've all come to take for granted just what Laurie said, this idea that artists can reinvent themselves. They can have different periods. They can have different styles. And we've all, sort of taken that in as the way culture goes in America now. But it is really worth remembering that around 1900, that didn't really happen. John Singer Sargent was a portraitist, and he did some landscapes. But, people tended to have one dimension, and they tended to have one style. And art historians love that because that makes our lives easier. What's more exciting to people like Laurie and Betsy and me is when you have complication and you have really varied careers and people who take on a number of different things at different times in different styles. And certainly with Rolfs and with the eight, we see a consistent need for personal expression and for artistic outlet. But what's exciting about it is that it takes so many different forms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I just want to add to this, Joe. I think you said that, you know, beautifully, that, you know, circa 1900 in American culture and the American artistic development is really a unique moment. It is uniquely self-aware of its position in relationship to the European cultural identity. And it really is striving for its own voice. And that, and there is a kind of self-consciousness, I think, in the that's apparent both in the work of the Eight and in Roth's. And I guess what this says about it, sort of the evolution of American art, it sort of takes a while for American artists to realize that they can separate themselves from the European heritage, that they can find what is uniquely American about themselves.
Oh, that's interesting. And what is uniquely American about the Eight, do you think, Elizabeth?
Well, they were, I think the leader of the group was definitely Robert Henri, and he came back from a successful early career in Paris and arrived in New York and said, you know, life is about contemporary life in the United States. Let's not paint any more pictures of European peasants. Let's paint the street scenes of Chicago, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Chicago, of New York, and or let's paint everyday life. Let's paint our contemporaries. And so they were not, they didn't have a social or a political agenda. They were very much artists. But the tremendous shift is towards painting things that were about American, American life, American people, American subjects. And that's certainly what set them apart in 1908.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we need to pause for a moment. We'll return and welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the current exhibition at the Milwaukee Art Museum, which is two, but really one. The artistic furniture of Charles Rolfe's is one of the exhibits, and then the work of eight American artists in the turn of the last century, 1909, they're called the Eight, and they go together beautifully. And we're talking about their importance and what you can find at the Art Museum in this new summer exhibit. I'm hoping that we're reaching some of you who have already seen the exhibit or if you have questions about it. One of the great things about this institution is that they not only found the descendants of someone like Charles Rolfe, they also brought some of the descendants to the museum, which I just love. The fact, oh, here in this corner is the great-granddaughter of Charles Rolfe. Oh, great. I just think it's marvelous that they find him in and highlight their ancestors' great achievements. They also have a whole series of book clubs going on. It's you can spend the whole summer involved in this project, and Lori will give us more information about those programs that are going on. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. Lori is the director of exhibits at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Joseph Cunningham is curator of the American Decorative Art 1900 Foundation in New York and author and curator of the book and exhibition, The Artistic Furniture of Charles Rolfe's. And we always like to mention Wisconsin Connections. He is a Wisconsin native and a graduate of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Elizabeth Kennedy, curator of collections at the Terra Foundation of American Art in Chicago. And we thank everybody for being with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls and emails now, and let's start with Michael from Milwaukee. Hello, Michael.
Yes, hi, Kathleen and guests. How are you today?
Fine, Michael. How are you?
Good. Okay. I always wanted to be an artist myself, and just delved in it somewhat briefly with, you know, some portraits, et cetera, that I used to do from pictures and all that. But I apologize. I missed the first half of your show, so I just tuned in frantically wanting to get on the show. And I was thinking about the pointillists and possibly Monet, Manet, the Impressionists. I don't even know who these eight American artists are, and do they have any affiliation with Monet and Manet and these folks?
They sure look like Impressionists. At least some of them do. Don't at least they did to me, Elizabeth. Am I way off?
Well, they're certainly all eight of artists were aware of European modernism that began with Monet and the group of French Impressionists. Robert Henri certainly was a huge fan of Manet, and he also was probably the most important teacher of art in New York City in the first decades of the 20th century, and he certainly taught Manet to his students. They were not followers, per se, in that they wanted to create something of their own, but they were very steeped in Western art history tradition and included the European modernists.
Have you seen the exhibit yet, Michael?
No, I have not. Can you tell me what's the fee over there now?
We have a general admission price for adults, which is $12, and that includes the exhibition. However, this would be a good weekend to come because I'm going to make a pitch for Lakefront Festival of the Arts, which is this weekend. And that general admission price is $10 for Lakefront Festival of the Arts. But you do get 50% off your ticket into the museum when you come this weekend, starting at noon on Friday. So it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And, you know, thank goodness Saturday and Sunday are supposed to be beautiful. So this would be a good day to come out and be on the lakefront.
And if you haven't been for a while, it's not going to rain, but should there be a few sprinkles, you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Under the tent. Kathleen, thank you so much for bringing that up. It's under the tent. Everything is inside. There are 172 artists. It's a juried exhibition of arts and crafts, and we had over 1,000 submissions, and the 172 artists who are going to be there are all fantastic. Some of them are old family friends.
Great. Yeah, it's quite an event with all that's going on there. You got the exhibit.
This is a great weekend to come.
It's a great weekend. Great. Michael, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Suzanne from Franklin next. Hi, Suzanne.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Who are the other seven? And the other seven of the American Eight. And Elizabeth, are you familiar with Robert Henry's Start in Life at Cozad, Nebraska?
Well, I am. Robert Henry has an interesting family history in that his real name was Robert Cozad.
That's right.
His father had an unfortunate tragedy in which he wound up killing one of his employees was later acquitted. But the family fled to the East Coast, and they all adopted separate names, and Robert Henry Cozad became Robert Henry.
It's
spelled H-E-N-R-I.
Right. I visited his home, the inn where the family did their living. I saw his top hat and his tuxedo and his mother's shawl when she was the inn hostess. I have a flyer on the unfortunate father business. I know that the father started another commune. But anyway, Elizabeth, I'm going to hang up and just thank you so much because I'm going to be going to see the eight, you know, so and take in the Lakeside show as well. This is a marvelous show. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Suzanne, so much for the call. Everybody's so enthusiastic today. They're brightening all our spirits. And we should talk about who the eight are. Please, Elizabeth.
Absolutely. The best way for me to remember is to go alphabetically.
Okay.
But there was Arthur B. Davies, William Glackens, Ernest Lawson, George Lukes, Maurice Prendergast, Everett Shinn, and John Sloan. Maurice Prendergast was the oldest of the group and the only one that was of the artists that was from Boston. The rest were resided in New York. And they Prendergast died around 1924, and Shinn and Sloan lived into the early 1950s. So I would say, as I mentioned earlier, they were mature artists around 2009, but they certainly, the majority of them lived through the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about how Henry became the leader of the group. What constitutes being a leader of the eight?
Well, he was just so charismatic, and he was a tall gentleman and very handsome, and went enthusiastic. What's interesting about Henry and his colleagues was the generation before Henry, William Merritt Chase comes to mind, was very much a dandy, very effete, had greyhounds for his dogs and very well dressed, and just very wanted to appeal to his Fifth Avenue clients. Robert Henri and his students and fellow colleagues were more masculine, if you will. They liked to play ball and go to the bars, but they were passionate about their art as well. So they brought a different attitude, I think, to contemporary art, one that said it's relevant to this moment and this day and not necessarily genteel. So in a way, I think it's a very modern moment in bringing contemporary art as a vital part of daily life.
Mm-hmm. And the other story that, I wanted to talk for sure, too, about how you found, you told this great story of how you found descendants through Social Security, Joseph, of Rolfs. And I know that some of them were at the preview, and I'm wondering if you found people who were descendants of the eight and why you bring these people and what their response is to seeing their great-grandfather's work, or you know, I guess they were all men in this case. It's quite something to have them there, isn't it, Lori?
It is a remarkable thing. You know, I typically work on dead European artists. So to be able to have this sort of closer connection with the family, I mean, it's a really interesting thing.
Yes.
And I have to say I'm a little jealous of my colleagues who work on more recent material because they can actually have those kinds of relationships. But, I can just say that the Rolfs family heirs were at every event. And, you know, the son was there as well. And so it was this sort of generation sort of coming together. I can't imagine what it would have been like for them. I mean, I'm sure they knew that their great-grandfather made furniture, that he was a kind of a unique, charismatic person. But I don't think they really understood the significance to the art historical community until, you know, Joe Cunningham put this together. So, you know, Joe actually was connected with them and spent a lot of time with their home, and so maybe he should follow up with that.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Right. Well, it certainly is extraordinarily exciting to sort of figure this kind of thing out about your family and to watch people learn from your own family records. And it's kind of one of those funny things where you keep things that are your family records for years and years and years, and then suddenly someone shows up at your doorstep who says they're really useful and valuable and that they would like to work with them. So I think they were a little bit shocked at first. And then we got to know them, and one of the other funny things that they started to be really interested in was just learning about how museums work, which is a whole different, you know, obviously a very different ball game from where they live as ranchers in far western Colorado.
Yeah, I would think so.
So they were kind of amused and then fascinated, and then, you know, Sarah and I spent a lot of time just explaining to them how the exhibition would be organized, how things were loaned, how, you know, how we were finding these objects all around the country, how we were doing our research. They became particularly excited actually at the prospect that we were interested not just in Charles Rolfs, but in particular his wife, Anna Catherine Green, who was an extremely important mystery novelist in the late 19th century. She is now regarded as America's first female mystery novelist, which was also very exciting for them to learn about because they really didn't know much about her either. And then we were, they were sort of flabbergasted when we started to reveal evidence that she had also participated in the design of some of the furniture. So it is this unraveling of family history in this case, which is not always the art historical mode. I mean, sometimes we're doing stylistic investigations or formal investigations or investigations that relate to style and design traditions and all of that sort of thing. But sometimes it really is the nitty-gritty of the family records and who did what and who designed what and what kind of drawings can we find and what has signatures and what doesn't, and all those kinds of little details that they actually became fascinated by. And the whole adventure that we were on in organizing the exhibition and book project became an adventure that they were able to participate in. And to see it come to fruition in Milwaukee at the exhibition has been incredibly exciting. And the other thing that's always important to remember about exhibitions is, and this is true for Betsy and Lori, for me, everyone in this business, we never have all these objects in one place at one time. The way the public comes into the exhibition and has this incredible luxury of seeing all these great paintings, seeing all this great furniture, all organized, put in a nice, tidy little area that looks beautiful and is well organized and is clear to them, but we don't ever experience it that way along the track of research.
True.
And so it is an incredible luxury for all of us to have this exciting material all together at once. And in particular, it was remarkable to watch Lisa Ortman, Charles Rolfe's great-granddaughter, react to seeing the objects herself.
Oh, how did she react?
Well, she was just overwhelmed. I mean, she was so pleased and so excited, and she just thought it was so beautiful, and that was very moving. She just felt... She felt so proud that her family had this tradition of, you know, having been involved in art and culture. And she's actually a sort of a frustrated writer. When she's not ranching out in far western Colorado, she actually has tried to write some fiction. And so I think that it was very inspiring to her to be reminded of the artistic tradition that is in her family and is sort of in her blood. And I think that was really exciting for her.
I was just going to say it runs in the blood to have these dual things going on.
That's
you know,
right.
You're a rancher and you're a writer and you're furniture making and a Shakespearean actor and you're a mystery novelist and you're making furniture on the side. It's just quite something.
Well, and it is tied up with the late 19th century in such a wonderful way. It's something that Laurie has been referring to a number of times as well, is that there was, you know, with Oscar Wilde's lecture tour in the late 19th century and all of these kinds of attentions to aesthetic matters, and the idea that how beautiful your home was could really influence your happiness. It could really, you know, contribute to your life. That kind of mode swept through America in the late 19th century and informed very much the way Charles and Anna Catherine lived together.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's something that's still with us.
Yeah.
You know, Lisa has material. I'm not sure whether she's aware of this, but she has material now for a book.
Yeah, there you go.
Knocking on her door and introducing herself.
Yeah. And what about the descendants? I don't know if you have had a chance to find out much about them, Elizabeth, of the eight. Are they artists? Are they around?
Well, actually, the descendants of the eight came to New Britain's exhibition of the eight, because William Glackens and his wife were from the Connecticut area. So there were descendants from the Glackens family that came to the exhibition. What was also interesting is many of the scenes were painted in New York or along the Connecticut River, and there were people that came up at the opening and said, well, I can tell you all about this section of this landscape because my grandfather lived here or there. And there was a real connection with the subject matter as well as the few descendants from the artists there as well.
Mm. You know, Joseph, I was thinking about getting these pieces from all of these places and meeting with the families and rounding out the details of their lives and the exhibitions. Tell me a little bit more about that process, Laurie. It takes a long time to put an exhibit like this together. And it's true, as Joseph said, we come in and think, oh, this is really nice, and never think what happens behind the scenes to bring all of this together and have it so beautiful.
You know, I can only go from my own experience, but typically a large exhibition organized with many loans from around the world, around the country, you know, and doing a serious sort of scholarly publication that goes with it and sort of giving serious thought to why your subject is meaningful can take 4 to 5 years, if not longer. Mm. I mean, I've heard of, you know, sort of major scholars at the Art Institute, curators at the Art Institute, for example, who have worked for 12 years on big projects. You know, you juggle a lot of different things at once, so you have a number of projects going, and you sort of time them so that they pop in, you know, sort of given years, because you want your area of the museum, whatever it is, to be lively and interesting, and you want to be able to make a connection with the community. So you really have to think about, you know, how to do that. So it is juggling a lot of different balls to sort of make it happen. One of the most difficult things, I mean, I sort of talked about this before on your show, but one of the most sort of difficult things now with any exhibition is the issue of insuring the works as they travel from these lenders, whether they're other museums or private lenders. After 9/11, insurance for art exhibitions quadrupled. It has now, you know, fortunately decreased to only being double what it was prior to 9/11. But it is one of those things that sort of that makes any exhibition organization complex. You know, and I have to say, with these two exhibitions, we've had great partners and great venues for the exhibitions. And you know, I really think it speaks to the new Milwaukee Art Museum post the Calatrava edition. We're a different museum. We have great partnerships throughout the world, throughout the United States, and I think we're doing great, serious, scholarly work. So, and I really think it's to the, you know, the Calatrava edition, which has really put us on the map. And it's brought a lot of new people to the museum. Other museum colleagues who come to our, from around the world, who come to our museum to see that we have great collections. We have fantastic collections of American furniture. We have fantastic collections of the eight. And Milwaukee really has a lot to be proud of in mm-hmm. what we do.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in hearing what Elizabeth thinks about our facilities here, because I agree with you. I don't even have to see art. All I have to, and I know I do see art when I'm there. Don't get me wrong, but I can walk in that building and stand there, as I've told you before, yeah. and just feel peaceful, and it's the most beautiful place in the city. I really believe that. What do you think of the joint, Elizabeth?
Well, I started working at the Terra in 2000. And very soon after that, I made a trip to Milwaukee and saw your collection, and my mouth dropped open. Hmm. I mean, the American art collection, whether it's painting or decorative arts, is extraordinary in Milwaukee. And it really is an interesting story about the project with the eight, because the loans only came from three institutions. In one sense, it made it very easy, but it was easy because the collections were so rich and they were so had so many works by the artists in depth. And it took several years talking to curators in Milwaukee and in New Britain to saying, you know, this is sort of different to just have three institutions to come together, but we have the wherewithal because our collections are A-plus paintings that we can feel like we're not missing anything by just using what we have to tell this remarkable story. And then the Calatrava building was built, and it was like, oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. So we're I can't say enough wonderful things, not only about the building and the collection, but also the staff at MAM. It has been one of my most rewarding partnerships. Mm-hmm. I've felt like a member of the community there, and it's been congenial, and I feel as if it's a real contribution in the museum world to come together as partners and collaborators during this difficult economic times and take our rich collections and make the best of them together.
Mm. What nice words those are for you to hear, Lori. Very nice.
Yeah, it's very sweet.
Yeah.
We have, you know, another collaboration coming up at the end of this week. There will be a symposium on both exhibitions dealing with what's modern about American art, 1900 to 1930. The public is invited to that. The session on Thursday, June 19th, is in Chicago. You can find out more about that online at www.mam.org, of course, or you can call the museum for information. And then on Friday, the second part, the second day of the symposium, is at the Milwaukee Art Museum. That's on June 20th. And that is free to the general public with general admission, museum admission. And it's a very exciting opportunity because what Joe mentioned earlier is that, you know, the research is ongoing. The public comes to the exhibition. They think it's finite. It's done. But for curators in the field, scholars in the field, it's an opportunity to see things together for the first time. And you make new assessments based on that. So the dialogue continues. And that's actually what's really exciting about a project like this is the opportunity. I mean, these kinds of exhibitions give us the opportunity to continue the dialogue.
Yeah. More phone calls if you'd like to join us in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we're talking about the current exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum, which is of the eight and the artistic furniture of Charles Rolfe's. And it's very, very good. And then this is the weekend when so much is going on. The Lakefront Festival of Arts is happening this weekend, and this exhibit, and there are conferences taking place, and it's the place to be. So join us if you'd like. We have a few more minutes left in the show at 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, our number is 800-486-8655. We were talking earlier about all that you put together in conjunction with an exhibit. You have a book club going on, et cetera. Where's the best – how do you get all the information about all that's happening? It's a lot.
The best place is to just check our website,
okay.
www.mam.org, or we have great receptionists that take your phone calls and answer whatever questions you might have about our scheduling. And we do have a lot going on, the book clubs, book salons. We also have express talks every Thursday throughout the summer on these two exhibitions. They start at noon on Thursdays, every Thursday. And those are by experts in the field, so you can get a firsthand private look at the material. And then I just mentioned earlier, I gave you some wrong dates for the symposium on the two exhibitions. The first date is Friday, June 19th, and that's Modernism Painting. That's in Chicago starting at 9 a.m., and that's at the Chicago Cultural Center. Part two of that symposium is Saturday, June 20th, in Milwaukee, starting at 10:30 and going to 5. So thank you for allowing me to correct that, Kathleen.
Sure. John is our next caller from Brown Deer. Hi, John.
Good morning. I'm not a great fan of some of the paintings of modern, but I do appreciate the fine workmanship of the furniture and art pieces. To me, it's amazing how these men were able to manufacture these pieces without the modern tooled steel, without the modern equipment. To me, I use manufacturing and I make my furniture, I make modern tooling. But to me, how they can do all this without the hardened tool steels and that sort of thing, I don't know how they do it or how they did it.
How do they do it, Joseph?
Well, it's a very exciting aspect of Rolf's work and something that I always love to talk about, because one of the most interesting things about his work, I think, is that he was entirely untrained as a cabinet maker or a furniture maker. He had been to the Cooper Union School in New York City in the 1860s, which, of course, was this very famous night school in New York, which really created the entire artisan class that built modern New York City in the late 19th century. So he took engineering classes and math classes and drafting classes and that sort of thing there, but he really had no formal training in joinery or cabinet making or any of the kind of traditional furniture making techniques. He actually really devised all of his own methods based on his own engineering skills. He did actually use some beautiful dovetail construction and did, you know, make some elegant joints now and then, but a lot of his joints are actually fairly simple. Things are glued and on end. They're sometimes screwed together, that kind of thing. And in particular, what's remarkable about his work is the carving, of course. The carved surfaces of his work are some of the most extraordinary carvings that have ever been made in America. And I think the exciting thing about how he learned to carve is that, again, it wasn't in a traditional furniture-making kind of educational system. It was actually based on his work in the cast iron stove industry. He was a pattern maker in the 1870s and 1880s, which meant that he made the mahogany templates that were carved and then became the molds for the cast iron parts. So when you see those beautiful decorated parts to late 19th century cast iron stoves, they were actually made based on mahogany templates, and that is actually how he learned to carve wood. So he learned to carve wood with the tools of the period, which were, of course, as you point out, much softer in nature. They didn't have the hardened steel. They didn't have the precision. But he actually had to develop his skills at the highest level, because the quality of the template determined the quality of the mold, which determined the quality of the final product of the cast iron stove. So he actually learned to carve not as a mode of personal expression, but actually as a method of precision for manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John, very much for your call. Armenta is next from Muskego. Hi, Armenta.
Oh, hello. Are you?
All right. How are you?
Oh, I'm just great. I want to thank you for this most wonderful, enlightening program today. But it encouraged me to call and ask I should preface this by saying a late friend of ours was just the works that he has done in oil are so wonderful and so beautiful that whenever I see them and they are displayed in his sister-in-law's home right now because he is deceased, and I feel as though his work should be shown somewhere. I don't want to wait. I won't be around 200 years from now. And I hope, you know, that someone could discover Harold Sanders and how would his sister-in-law go about showing his works, you know, so that the people could see what this man did with nature, and everything is original, and self-portrait and his wife's portrait. It's just unique and beautiful. So I would like to be able to encourage her. In fact, I did call her this morning to encourage her somehow to put Harold's works on display.
Oh, we have about a minute. Lori?
Yeah, absolutely. The best thing to do would be to, you know, wait about an hour or so, wait for me to get back to the museum, and call our general line and ask for me, Lori Winters, and the number is 224-3200. That's 414-224-3200, and we're always interested in and looking at works of art, older works of art, or works by contemporary artists as well.
You never know. You could be on to the next big discovery. Thank you very much for the call. For all your enthusiastic calls today, everybody's enthusiastic. You bring that out in people. Lori, thank you, everybody, for being with us. Lori Winters, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, the email, I mean, the website again is what?
www.mam.org.
Mam.org. Okay. And Joseph, thank you ever so much for being with us.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you.
Yeah, it was great fun. Lori Winters, Director of Exhibits at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Joseph Cunningham is Curator of the American Decorative Art 1900 Foundation in New York and author of The Artistic Furniture of Charles Rolfe's. And Elizabeth Kennedy, Curator of Collection at the Terra Foundation of American Art in Chicago. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, major documentary on Iran, which is, of course, all over the news this week, and we'll be talking about that the first hour of the program. The second, pretty exhaustive biography of I.F. Stone, so we'll be talking about that, hour number two. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 11 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.